Well, welcome, and thanks so much for attending. I'm humbled by this, but also there's so many people in the audience that should surely be up here as well. We've got a lot of wonderful breeders with exciting programs, so I'm doing this for the rest of you out there. Today's presentation will emphasize for students as well as faculty to try to give you a wide breadth of the program. But while we're talking about genetics and genomics, a huge emphasis will be the difficulties we have phenotyping, because your genetics and genomics are only as good as what you're putting into it. So to the students in the audience, I think it's important, and what we've all learned is that it's important to find your passion. If you're not going to be passionate about the crop that you're working on, who else is? So for granting agencies, for publications, for working with the media, you really have to love what you're doing. If you don't love it, try to find something that you do love. And never stop asking why. We have a wonderful community. By a breeding program, you kind of have to be a jack of all trades. So asking other people for help and finding out that they're more than willing to do it is wonderful. And try to know the literature and really analyze the literature. Just because it's written doesn't mean that it's right. And so it's important to really have that down. And then for those of you that might be looking for interviews, it's really important to do your homework. With the days of internet searching now, to go to a meeting and not know who you're talking to, not know their research, is kind of inexcusable. So that's the advice that I could give searching on search committees, is that sometimes people come and they really haven't done their homework. Try to have focus, and I'm smiling when I say that, because you'll see the breadth of my program that I probably should listen to my own advice. But we have summer scholars that come for 8 weeks, and what's been really educational to me is that in this 8-week period, kids come sometimes without any training in agriculture, and at the end of 8 weeks, they've done a research project and done a poster. And this is Silas Child from West Virginia. He came, he left, fortunately, with a supportive family, a 1, 2, and 3-year-old at home, and did a research project, and he looked at leaf lobing in apple, which no one had looked at. And the beauty of working in apple sometimes is that you can look at projects that really haven't been done yet. And he found that for leaf lobing from Malus fusca, 99.9% of the plants he could find one lobed leaf on, but they really weren't expressing throughout the tree. That was, he learned where you would see it. He found that suckers, because they're juvenile, might show lobing when the entire tree didn't. Yet, I have a follow-up student that found quite the opposite. So again, look at the literature, but then analyze it carefully. And if somebody, a summer scholar without training, can do a project and lead to a publication in 8 weeks, we should be able to do that. So focus helps. And then learn to tell your story. As you'll learn today, I'm a storyteller, maybe not the best storyteller, but a storyteller, and I come from a long line of storytellers. And good science should definitely tell a story. So you need to learn how to discuss your research in simple terms and use analogies where you can. You're not dumbing down the science, but you're making it so it's relatable to people. And then as students, learn to write and speak genuinely. I was able to take a class with Alan Alda. Younger generation knows him from Scientists Speak. Older generation knows him from MASH, which I did. But he also did a scientific program. And he taught improv to scientists. And I took it, and it was a stitch. Because they had physicists that were trying to improv. They had better keep their day jobs. But what it taught you is they did interviews where they taped you, and they did hostile interviews. So somebody stuck a microphone in my face and said, "You make Frankenfood, don't you?" And you got to see how you reacted to it. And it was a game changer. If I had taken it earlier in my career, so those of you that are young in your careers, take something like that because it makes you less afraid to talk to the media or to explain your research. If you can't explain your research to your aunt, you're doing something wrong. Now, some aunts are different than others, but you get the general idea. For me, it's really nice that I work on a crop that people are interested in. So apples, I mean, there's a lot of people that are fanatics about apples. You know, you make artwork that all of those are single apples made into artwork. We did it ourselves at the experiment station. I partnered with a photographer from LA that came out and took pictures of the genetic diversity of our apple trees. But what's great is by having something that people connect with, it makes your science more relevant. Now, from a genetic perspective, you know you're in trouble when your crop doesn't really have a straight name. So Malus domestica, Malus pumila, Malus sylvestris, we're getting there. It's an ancient allopolyploid that behaves like a diploid. We also have triploids, tetraploids, and apomix. There's 25 to 34 species, depending on who's talking about it. We have gametophytic incompatibility and inbreeding. And what's good about that is it enhances and makes apples diverse. They're among the most diverse crops that you could work on. But what's bad is then you can't use the traditional methods of back crossing because of inbreeding depression. And then they're clonally propagated, so once we find something that's good, we can fix it. And with the origin of apple being from the Kazakhstan and northern China, I'm showing the Botany of Desire because it emphasizes my point about telling a story. Michael Pollan wrote about the Kazakh forests. We had people that would drive by motorcycle across country and show up on our doorstep saying, "I want to walk in the Kazakh forest." That's pretty powerful, and it drew attention to germplasm. Now, the Kazakh forest, Gennaro's in the audience, doesn't look that much different than a regular forest, but they get excited, and they ask for seed, and they started understanding where our food came from. So again, it shows that the importance of a story and how it relates to saving genetic diversity. So at the repository at Geneva, I'm really lucky because I have a great team of researchers I can interact with. They house over 3,000 apple accessions, which, being cheap, they take care of, so I don't have to, which is pretty sweet. And it's a wonderful opportunity to collaborate and use material that you might not use otherwise. I throw this in always just because in diverse audiences, but not necessarily this one, a lot of people still think it's as American as apple pie, but when the settlers came here, Malus fusca and others were the type of apple that we had. And Thoreau described it as the apples here were sour enough to make a jaybird scream. So we started at a pretty low level, but thank goodness we had imports from Europe. So for Cornell apple breeding, we're one of the oldest programs in the country. We're one of the largest in the world. We're one of only three full-time apple breeding programs. And while we use primarily traditional breeding, we also have worked in transgenic technology, and that is continuing. We're an advocate for both, but we think that people have to weigh what the benefits are. And I learned in talking to people that people really do not understand the difference between crossing and GMO or transgenic technology. So I spoke to the Wall Street Journal, and people wrote about Snapdragon, and they said, "Stop this Frankenfood madness." So seeing how we like to talk about stories, I learned a pretty easy analogy. If you're a parent, those are my two stellar offspring, sometimes, you know about genetic modification. And people can get that. Okay, I'm a parent. Yes, I see that genes segregate. It's not transgene technology. It's just genetic modification. But I spoke to a grower group, and I was trying to use this analogy before I had practiced it. And I said, "Well, for example, you have a beautiful wife and you want to have a child that looks just like her, but the child gets some of your genes. And the growers went, ooh, burn. And then they were like, ooh, you owe him a beer. So I'm refining this discussion, but it does seem to resonate with people. Apple breeding is all about consumer satisfaction. And we've learned for consumer satisfaction that consistency of quality is important. If you get a bad apple, ironically, you remember it as worse than it was. And if you get a good apple, you remember it as better than it was. So you're between a rock and a hard place because it's never going to quite compare. So we want it to be consistent across locations, across growing regions. And we know, even though we all are breeding for flavor, that the most important attribute is crispness. A consumer will rate crispness higher than any other category. But let's give them that and give them flavor. So we know texture, flavor, juiciness, sugar, and acid are important. We also need long storage and shelf life. I have my collaborators, Chris Watkins and Jackie Knock in the back, that put my varieties through the ringer, and I will never say that my varieties are perfect again because I have been proven wrong, but that's why you have collaborators in post-harvest physiology. And I changed this. I used to say free from disorders, but now I say free from major disorders. We use the wine wheel because you might think, I used to be asked to describe an apple flavor and I'd say it's kind of apple-y. Or if you want to get like the older school, we used to say it was sprightly, a nice combination of sugar and acid. There's only so many descriptors you can use, but actually when you have a breeding program, you'll find green pepper notes, diesel, unfortunately, cherry, cinnamon, nutmeg, mushroom. All of those flavors are available. And so that's what I love about apple, because we have apples that have a hint of anise. If you like anise, it's wonderful. If you hate anise, it's awful. And it's about 50-50 by people who eat those apples. But my friend who works on cabbage, you'll notice that cabbage is between wet dog and burnt match. So I'm looking good. So our goal is to produce superior apples. Consistent, better crispness, better appeal. I got the gene for chocolate, so I want us to be the chocolate of all fruit. My daughter, when she was 4, had chocolate for the first time, and she went, oh, mommy. And my husband said, the gene has been activated. So let's turn that gene on for apples. We want better nutrition. We want unique flavor profiles. However, better requires complex traits. So we're making tremendous progress with rose breed and molecular markers. But the more complex a trait it is, the more you really have to pay attention to what you're measuring, whether it's consistent across germplasm or not. So these are two different progenies, one fruit from several different trees. And you can see in one progeny, you may get segregation for size, color, shape. And the other, Braeburn by 674, which is the progeny that Ruby Frost came from, actually is very uniform in appearance and shape and, you know, segregation for color. But what that cross segregated for was flavors, vitamin C, non-browning. And so anytime you're making assumptions on a progeny, it may not relate to the other progeny. At Cornell, collaboration is key, and I know I'm going to leave somebody out. The thing I love about our program is I'm fascinated by everything, but I don't have to be an expert in anything, which is fortunate. So we have plant physiologists, pomologists, post-harvest physiologists, genomicists, pathologists, entomologists, food scientists, and they've all been so generous with their time. So when I'm presenting the accomplishments that I've had, it really is reflected in my collaborators and in my graduate students like Pat Connor, who fortunately I did not find a picture of, otherwise I would have embarrassed him. Too late, I already did. Okay, so we have some well-known apple varieties. Cortland is turning 100 this year, so a variety that was released in 1915 is still on the market. McCowan, not McCoon, is... you knew you were saying it wrong. 1923, Empire in 1968, and Jonna Gold, which took off in Europe and Belgium, was a variety there before it was here. Roger Way got hosted with a parade in Japan in recognition for his work there. That's, so tell the apple growers I'm waiting. So apple varieties and how they're named and made. I get myself in trouble, as you can tell. I told Cheryl Hampson that I have about 20 minutes where I behave. I think I had less today. And then it kind of goes downhill from there. But I was speaking to a group, and this is a true story. I was explaining how we have to get flowers at the bloom stage to collect pollen. We screen out the pollen. And then on the bottom, we want bees to be kept from joining the flowers and creating contamination. So with our fingernails, we remove the petals and the stamens so that we just have the styles and stigmas to pollinate. And I said, I came home when I was first married, and I said to my husband, God, I'm tired. I've been emasculating all day. And he said, you really shouldn't talk like that in public. I still do. But so we have to make those crosses, and we have a very short period when we can do this. But, you know, so media will come out and say, look like you're having fun. It's just like, okay. But that's the period where we can make the difference between having a program and not having a program. And then we're fortunate to have people like Gennaro, where once, so I plant my apples on their own roots just because it's cheaper. We'll grow them out in about 4 years. I'll start to see fruit. If I see something I like, I will propagate it. So I'll take a bud, I'll put it on a rootstock, and we're lucky to have a rootstock breeder there. And then I could make as many copies of those trees as needed. I won't use ain't, but in breeding and genetic studies, apples are not Arabidopsis. It's not for the faint of heart. If you want to have an easier career, Arabidopsis, tomato, sorry for the tomato breeders, but apples and citrus are tough. So we have a lot of genetic diversity. We have a lot of diseases and disorders, and then we have a lot of unusual things that we see. So if you're looking for a lot of gels today, I'm going to disappoint you, but I'm going to show you the stuff that you never get to see in a breeding program, and you don't get to see in a journal because we tend to hide our dirty linen a little bit, but it's the dirty linen that's fun. And you see stuff and you go, oh my God, can that really be what's happening within these breeding programs? So any study in specialty crops is characterized by variability. Apple is no exception. There's variability about location in the tree, sun side versus shade side. One of the post-harvest physiologists was saying that if you're using a certain meter, you have to use the shade side because otherwise the data doesn't make sense. If the fruit is a lateral fruit versus a king fruit. And so if you're doing a genomic study or looking at gene expression and you're using the king fruit and then switch to a lateral, there's going to be a change. Similarly, if you're picking off the king fruit, the ethylene that's released can also screw things up. So you really have to think about what you're doing. Crop load effects. A heavy crop fruit is going to be a lot different than a light crop fruit. And then the harvest time. Are you harvesting it for regular storage or CA? And then the age of the tree and the rootstock used. So people hate when papers come to me because I'm like, what's the parent? What's the age? What's the this? Because it all matters. Maturity, and this shows you that starch iodine works for some cultivars but doesn't work for a lot of cultivars and varieties. The stage of development, making sure that you're doing it at the same time. And then you can see there's some king dominant varieties, so the center of the cluster is a big apple and the laterals are smaller. That makes a difference in what you're looking at. So I had a person that specializes in epigenetics come to my research station, and I wanted to show him a progeny that we were going to look at whether there was epigenetic modification of the columnar gene. And he looked at me, scratched his head, and said, I never thought I would say this, but you have too much diversity. It's not a bad thing. Just because he couldn't handle it. So this is kind of an example of looking at something. So red skin color. Should be simple, known that red is dominant to yellow. So we developed a marker for it, but it didn't work for grain apples. Now MIB transcription factors have been identified in apples, grapes, and other crops. There's been transgenic studies overexpressing. different genes, and they have profound effects, with some of them being nearly lethal. However, and Paul Sandifor had a great poster on molecular markers and color, the amount of color and the intensity and the pattern can differ. The two apples on the bottom, any guess how they differ? Same variety, Gala. One is overmature and one is mature. So you could make an assumption, if you don't know the variety, that you know, they're different stages or different attributes, and they may not be. This is what fascinated me, and this is why I love having summer scholars and graduate students. If you have a red-fleshed variety, so red gene is dominant for foliage color, usually you see really dark red, and then it progresses to lighter green as you go up the stem. And this is characteristic. So if you use basketoon or anything derived from Malus nidzwitzkiana, you get really red leaves, and then it gets lighter. So I had a graduate student, or a summer scholar, come, and she did a progeny of a red-leafed variety by a green-leaf variety. And she came back and showed me the data, and she had 100% green leaves, which with the dominant gene is a little concerning. And she said, how do you explain this? And I said, well, this is one of the cases where it really doesn't make sense. But if you see here, they are green leaves, but do you see the new growth? I've never seen that before, where it starts out green and then the later offshoots are red. So is it gene expression that's delayed relative to stage of maturity? It's fascinating, and that's what I love about this, is that you think you know it, and then something happens that you say, well. So I was relieved that we have red color, but I don't know why I didn't show till then. So that's a summer scholar. We found red and purple are different. So if you see the leaf, it's pretty weird that you see purple coloration on half the leaf and green coloration on the other. Why? That'll be another study. But we're going to have some beautiful ornamentals that have lobed leaves as well as red leaves. In her population, lobing was expressed in 50% of the population, as opposed to the previous study that I told you, you would see one lobed leaf. That's the kind of variation she saw within her progeny, one leaf from several different seedlings. So that's Malus cutleaf Schmidt, and you can see that the lobing is strongly inherited and the color is segregating, and we'll have to figure that out. Rose Breed, Amy Iazzoni and others are in the audience, has been wonderful because it is helping us with DNA markers. And we've been looking at, in the first Rose Breed, quality traits. And now in the second Rose Breed, traits related to disease resistance. And that has been wonderful. But what I think was the best part of Rose Breed is that it really brought our community together. Had breeders talking about what things we share very common ideals and goals. We share very similar attributes. We all have wonderful senses of humor, Senja and Cheryl. So we have fun when we get together. But the other thing is we used our germplasm. We shared it across a lot of programs. So my program coupled the research with Kate Evans' program, with Jim Luby's program, and it allowed us to really leverage that. And that was great. And so if anybody heard Kunung Zhu's paper today, we found that for a lot of breeding programs, the linkage group 16 is the most important. For my breeding program, linkage group 8 is also very important. And it showed how our choice of germplasm is affecting stuff. And we are getting verification of pedigrees. I always have to be careful because I've insulted one of my colleagues before, but you can understand when a pollen parent's wrong because maybe a bee came by, but some of us have gotten seed parents wrong. That's a little tougher to do. You should know what fruit, or, you know, what tree it came from. And we learned that a lot of things that didn't make sense because the parentage was wrong. We have a number of participants in Rose Breed, and it has been a lot of fun. I bought the book just for the cover. I got called once when I was starting in my career and still had this sense of humor, and a guy said, I have sheep's nose and leather coat. And I paused a minute and I said, take two aspirin and call me in the morning. And there was silence, and I went, oh no, probably shouldn't have done that. And then he laughed, and I was like, okay. We have a fruit that is incredibly healthy. A lot of the antioxidants are in the skin, but a lot of them are also in the flesh. We have already achieved markedly higher vitamin C by intercrossing high varieties by high varieties. There are numerous beneficial attributes, such as quercetin, supposed to be good for the memory. If that's the case, got to eat more apples because it's not always showing. But it's important, again, when you're doing antioxidant work, to understand the variability inherent in apples. So crop load, location effects, best extraction method, and whether it's bioavailable. We've had researchers look at compounds that aren't bioavailable. So you're looking at a compound, but your body doesn't take it in. So what good is it? So that's been very good, but very complex. This is the phenolic compound biosynthesis pathway. And I have to use it as a cheat sheet because we're looking at certain compounds, and you can see that there's a, you know, you affect one part of the pathway, you're going to affect something else. Really good work by Verdue in terms of QTL mapping relative to polyphenolic content in cider apples. Lot of really good research. I'm amazed that every day there's at least one new paper on new genes or QTLs in apples. So we're really making progress. We're looking at floridizin. Floridizin is a compound made in apple leaves. It accounts for like 80% of the leaf composition. It's important in both glucose absorption, so for diabetic research, they're very interested in it. And it's also useful for a number of other things. The range in Malus species is huge. I have a graduate student that is working for the USDA. Once he completes his research with me and another USDA faculty member, Ganyuan Zhang, he'll have a USDA position as a geneticist. And he's been looking at floridizin not only in mapping populations, but in the germplasm collection, and they're also doing genome-wide sequencing to look at some of the attributes. Now, antioxidants, linkage group 16 is a hot spot. So this is the top of the linkage group is a hot spot for antioxidants. It's also where malic acid, one of the major loci, is bitter pit, which is calcium disorder, self-incompatibility alleles, juice browning. And so what we're starting to look at, and some other traits that I can't talk about yet, but will be a very exciting publication for one of my graduate students, we're wondering if some of the selection that occurs on the top of this linkage group is bringing along, if there's linkage between desirable and undesirable traits. Because we're seeing in some cases that high acid fruits have good storage or less browning, and the lower acid fruits may or may not. So we did look at reduced flesh browning and high vitamin C. Liberty, which is a scab resistant variety, browns very roughly, and 674, which is from our program, does not. Reason we started looking into it is with the introduction of apple dippers, McDonald's started buying 55 million pounds of apples. And they would love to not have to use one of the treatments for vitamin C for browning. Because if you've seen some of the literature, I love where they go, and they drench it with toxic compounds. Well, it's vitamin C. You know, it's, but convenience sells. And we are, this was an easy project to do. We didn't know what we'd find, and the findings were so much better than we anticipated. For browning and for vitamin C, the varieties tend to be between the two parents. So if you do a high vitamin C by a high vitamin C, you're going to get higher vitamin C than most varieties. Same for browning. So most varieties are 5 to 10 milligrams of vitamin C. 674 Autumn Crisp has 19 to 20, and Braeburn has 32. But the beauty of those are is they're stable in storage. So we can have a variety that has high vitamin C and it keeps it through storage. And we have stuff that's as good as Braeburn, and we have stuff that's better than Cortland for resistance to flesh browning. And then, as I said, certain phytochemicals are even more important than these two compounds, but people get vitamin C. So, you know, we're working on those as well. So as I said, the fresh cut market is very important. Convenience does sell. And serving size for schools, daycares, jails, and hospitals are half an apple. And those are also the places you least likely want to have knives. So having pre-cut apples are a good thing for those markets. We have a grower, and he was telling somebody that his apples were, you know, he did a big prison selling, and he also sold on the market. And this legislator came up to him and said, "My mother really loves your apples." And without missing a beat, the grower said, "How many years is she in for?" flesh and juice browning. We have linkage group 10, 15, and 17 for flesh browning, linkage group 16 for juice browning, but we're making headway, and at least it's not like apple allergens, they're on every linkage group. So you're like, oh, that's going to be difficult, but here we're narrowing it down. And this is Ruby Frost or New York 2, 12 hours after it was cut, not treated with anything. Now, to be fair, being variable, that's not always what you're going to see, but that's pretty good. We had nurseries come, and I cut it, and we came back, and they were like, oh my God, it really is good. I show this not to make a point against Arctic apples, but just how clever the anti-GMO categories are. I mean, that's a pretty compelling ad. As scientists, we're not going to dress our babies up as Snow White and say, don't do this, but you know, they've got a lot of money and are saying McDonald's and Gerber say no. Now it's the USDA's turn. What I've been telling people about this is you have to ask yourself, is non-browning enough of a commercial attribute? And I think the consumers will dictate that. We do have robust regeneration and transformation of apple, so that we're very fortunate in that regard. And there's a lot of things being looked at for transgenic apples, but disease resistance is probably first and foremost. There's multiple approaches, different genes, different promoters, different groups working on it. We tried at Cornell to do chitinase, and we found that if we tried to express chitinase in sufficient volumes for resistance, the plants only grew about this big. So the effect of the transgene has to be considered. Cisgenic transformation, where you're not using selectable markers, may be perceived better by the industry, and there's some wonderful papers about that. But what I love about the transgenic work, whether you're for it or against it, is in every case it teaches us something about the gene that we're looking at. And that's powerful because we learn something that we didn't know before. Now, ironically though, people jump on the bandwagon. This is Opal Apple, and they had to pay to prove that it was GMO free, even though every apple in the marketplace except for the Arctic series is GMO free. But they're the only certified GMO free apple. And you're gonna see that a lot more. They also do something neat though, they do social marketing where if you buy their apples they contribute to food banks or to education of migrant workers, so that's good. I'm showing a lot of pictures that I'm one of those that like to see the visuals. I can't show you the visuals for apple quality as easily as I can for some of the other traits. So I'm gonna use architecture and other traits as a key. So in each case, these are the two trees have the same parents. One is columnar and one is columnar dwarf. The tree on the bottom that looks like a bush, I call it the cousin it tree. It's got scab resistance. It's got decent quality. I see Dwayne Green going, sunlight interception is not there. So, I mean, we got some problems there, but what a neat thing to look at what the branches are doing, and we're learning what genotypes contribute to upright branching, what produce too much branching. We have genetic dwarfs, we have weeping type, which if you try to study, you have to tell the farm crew not to apply herbicide. Well, we learned that lesson the hard way. But look at that. I mean, Terrence says, let's have good crotch angles. I got a little carried away genetically there. I mean, we want them upright. That's a weeping type. The four trees that you see are segregating for columnar habit and susceptibility to powdery mildew. There are so many genes ripe for the picking. And so physiologists, post-harvest physiologists in the audience, I've said this before, if you see something that you like and you think that it might help your study, talk to me, because there's so many things that are cool that people could look at. So for apple quality, nothing like having graduate students. I had a graduate student that measured the force to break an apple cube open. And if you orient an apple cube one way, it ruptures, and then you do it another way, and it just kind of fizzles out. And she was able to use this machine to show the force required to rupture cells. And so Honeycrisp is very popular because the cells rupture and juice is released, where some varieties separate between the cells. We're doing increased firmness. We've markedly increased firmness. We've increased Brix and sugar. We've increased apples, but with flavor. So I have an apple that has 20 degrees Brix. Most varieties are 10 to 13 degrees. 20 degrees Brix, but 1.2 in malic acid. It's like having a shock tart, but it's also highly flavored. I think there's a place in the marketplace for these really highly flavored apples, and that part is just fun because you can ruin families from ever eating apples again because they try some of these and then they're like, you know, can we get them? And David Karp knows about that. So we are blessed to have the apple genome sequenced, over 57,000 genes. Malus diversii is the progenitor, but people are still arguing about that. But that's helped so many different investigations, and it will continue to do so. Disease resistance. I have to admit, and Jules has been doing scab resistance for a long time, you have to have a cast iron stomach to evaluate a lot of disease resistant varieties because they tend to have higher acidity and astringency. But it's worth it because it will pay off. So we have resistance to apple scab, fire blight. The bacterial disease is a huge problem because now we have strep resistance, so the major antibiotic to control it is not effective. We're having another antibiotic that we're going to be able to use from Michigan, but we know what the fate of that will be. And then powdery mildew as well. So apple scab, Honeycrisp, part of Rosebreed, is examining that Honeycrisp actually has some genes for resistance. We knew in the field it has good field resistance, but we're trying to parse out the genes for resistance. And the reason I show this is when we were talking about genetics and genomics, when we published our first molecular marker on scab, the reviewers said, but Susan, your lesion type keeps changing. Like they weren't going to accept the manuscript. And it was like, that's because it keeps changing. I mean, it's tough because you have a hypersensitive response, little pinpoint prick, but then you might have other characteristics. So we're learning more about the proper conditions. That stellate necrotic reaction on the top, little star-shaped lesion, is indicative of resistance from Russian seedling, and all of the breeding programs are trying to pyramid resistance so that we will not have erosion of that resistance. If the leaf after inoculation gets that coating, it's scab resistant. The beauty of that is when you wait for that tree to fruit, it would be scab resistant, so we can reduce the population at that stage. However, we had scab resistance and we had resistance to rust. The resistance to rust is a hypersensitive response. Dave Rosenberger, who admittedly has more cedar apple trees on his planting than anyone should ever have, but he wants to look for susceptibility. Those trees will get a rust-induced spotting. So they don't get rust, but they get the spotting. We're learning how to deal with that. As I said, fire blight is devastating. We've had growers that were on a tour and were just about crying. It'll kill young trees, it'll kill older trees. Hail increases the avenue of entry, and that's increasing in our area. We have different sources of resistance. Jane Arelli and Herb Aldwinkle before him are looking at this, but how quickly can we incorporate them? And as I said, this is an important aspect of Rosebreed. I'm going to use Chris Watkins. I put Michigan here because we don't get fire blight in New York State. Wink, wink. Other areas that I just find fascinating is the original Gala was a bicolored apple. Original Delicious was, the original Macintosh was, and as genetic sports have occurred, or strains, then there is a redder branch. Problem with the redder branch is as we go for higher fruit color, the same pathway can influence the volatiles that are being perceived. So a lot of people will argue that the original variety is better than the subsequent sports. But what makes certain varieties more prone to mutation? So for example, I just told you that Delicious does a lot of sports, Macintosh does a lot of sports. Empire Apple, which has been grown since 1968, only two sports on record. Why is that? So we would like to know that, and we'd like to understand what causes those transitions, because it could be for spur type and other characteristics. So I'm going to have a poster of every chimera I found in the orchard, and we've had a game of it, but I've never seen a 3-1. I don't know if you can really see, but those are three different distinct layers. That tree there I was ready to discard, because as much as I have a broad focus, I'm brutal. Somebody said, your apple seedlings are your kids, and I said, well, then I must be a lousy mother, because they don't shape up and they get the axe. You can't do that with your own kids, but with seedlings you can. That tree, every fruit is chimeric. So what is causing it to do that? So if people are interested, let me know. New varieties from Cornell. Fortunately, despite this broad interest, I've had two good varieties that have been released and our industry has embraced. New York One from Honeycrisp. Chris Watkins says that we're using Honeycrisp to keep post-harvest physiologists in business. You're welcome. But we did find when you use a parent like Honeycrisp that you see the sins of the father or mother in the offspring. So you'll see the soft scald and the bitter pit and the biennial bearing, but you also get that delicious texture. I told a group in Spain that sometimes the fruit from Honeycrisp is like styrofoam, and they asked very nicely, is that a good thing? It's not. but it does teach you about what traits can be played with. So New York One has been named Snapdragon, New York Two has been named Ruby Frost, Jules is gonna think of a better name, but well, we won't go there. And then down below is the growers that joined NIAG. Every grower in New York State had the opportunity to grow these two apples. Chris does a panel and we pick at five different harvest dates. And what's good about that is growers still want to pick when it's closer to tree ripe. And what you put in at tree ripe in storage is not the same. And so we've been able to demonstrate through that if you pick at this stage after X months of storage, it isn't good or it is good. And we've learned that these apples don't behave in the traditional way for starch iodide or internal ethylene. So I learned valuable intellectual property, negotiating and marketing skills. What I loved is my two-page article in The Good Fruit Grower would have cost me $30,000 if I had put an ad in, so free publicity is good. It was heralded at the university. We have the commissioner of ag there. He said if he had to go to the governor and say Susan sold her apple to Minnesota or Washington, it was going to be a long walk back to his office. So this was a good thing for our industry and for others. However, we will have open releases and we'll have possibilities for other arrangements. The logos that they did I thought were really good. Snapdragon Monster Crunch, Ruby Frost Cool, Crisp, and Craveable. But the best part of my job was to do taste tests with consumers in Wegmans. And I had a family that had four little girls and the mom says they don't like apples. And I said, oh, just try this. And their faces lit up and they said, we love this apple. And she was shocked, and I was, you know, could you say that again? So to see your apples in the grocery store, Snapdragon and Ruby Frost, has been tremendous. I asked my husband, who tries to tamp down my enthusiasm, and I said, so what was it like at the grocery store with, you know, the displays? And he said, people were lining up for miles. Yeah. They weren't, but they were enthusiastic, and they've been selling really well. What I like to do is think outside of the box. That apple with the starburst lenticels is not photoshopped. Occurs naturally. We cross that by something with prominent lenticels. We got these wildly freckled apples. I was really excited. Chris used a picture of them in an extension newsletter, and somebody wrote and said, "What the heck is wrong with those apples?" Oh, was it? I feel better now. You never told me that part. We grew columnar apples in cages because we found that if you had scab-resistant columnar apples, the insects don't know enough to go up and over. So you could grow trees without any pesticides. And my mom saw those and said, "Oh, honey, I want one." So it's not going to be commercial, but it still was interesting from an insect's physiology. We have good old-fashioned russets that are better, and we want to have that wow factor. That's an apple tree. Apple leaves, apple flower. I wouldn't have believed if I hadn't seen it myself. We're trying, we did some OP seeds and we don't get that leaf type, but I used the same parent and I got another strange leaf like this in a progeny. So it's a mutation, but it's repeatable. And, what am I going to do with it? I think that understanding about leaf size and leaf would be very interesting. And it also, as you notice, has spurs up and down the trunk, which is unusual for apple plants. If I cross columnar by regular, that's the variation from regular size habit to columnar habit. Those suckers are like tobacco leaves. What is it that's causing the larger size? And for marker work, as I said, it's important to know what you're missing. So when you look at skewed segregation distortions, it might be the lethal gene that operates in apples, so with pale green lethal, but it could be some of these genetic dwarfs that most breeders let them die right away. I keep everything that other people throw out. Jim Luby was cute, and he said, "Well, Susan, I can give you my crap, too," which I'd probably take. But it helps us understand. So if you only kept the good plants, you're missing all those genes that are segregating and might be linked with the dwarf habit. But the other thing is that really weird rolled leaf that looks like herbicide injury. It's not herbicide injury. It's a dwarf plant. My technician knows how crazy I am, so he put it in the nursery and was able to keep it alive. Still hasn't fruited, but again, what genes are operating there? So he laughs because he said, if I found a genetic dwarf russet with scab resistant, I'd be over the moon. But it's true, but those are the things that if you just let them die, you're missing part of the equation. So future areas. We know climate change is important. It's in 2012, we lost our crop, earliest spring in 50 years. The last frost-free day is mid to late May. We had really late bloom and we had multiple frost events, and I anticipate that will continue. We have new southern diseases. See Glomerella leaf spot, problematic in the south and in Brazil and Chile. We're seeing the other part of the Glomerella issue, which is bitter rot. And so now we're having to look at different genetic sources for resistance. Post-harvest diseases, I thought Chris might be here, so this is my kudos, Jennifer. Post-harvest is huge. You can have perfectly good fruit that looks great, and then it comes out. And when I first did post-harvest screening, Dave Blampede was there. And we took the stuff out of storage, and he looked at me, and he smiled, and he said, "Susan, I've never seen so many disorders." And he was thrilled, and I was like, so we don't have as many as in the past. We're working on it. We have new invasives. Black stem borer, or ambrosia beetle, is problematic through all sorts of ornamental areas, but it when a plant dies, it gives off ethanol. The beetles are susceptible, sent into the ethanol, and so that they go to trees that are winter damaged or have in flooding conditions. And not only do they burrow in, but this is the part that I'm fascinated by, the beetle has a sac of fusarium, bores into the tree, injects the fusarium grows to, I guess, feed the brood, and that's what kills the tree rather than the insect. It's huge. Are we going to be able to find genetic resistance to this? I don't think so, but it just shows that no matter how many tools you have in your arsenal, there's always one that's going to be challenging. Hail. I was watching a morning news show, and it said, hail in Geneva, New York. I'm like, good morning, America. And I yelled to my husband, did we have hail? And he said, yeah. I said, you're supposed to tell me that. But he didn't tell me because he knew that's how I was going to be reacting. It was awful, just absolutely awful, cover in the ground. So are we going to have hail nets in New York? And if we have hail nets, we know that there's an influence on fruit color and volatiles and everything else. We have food safety issues that continue to be a concern. Who remembers ALAR here? Okay, so ALAR was used as a stop drop. Meryl Streep got all involved and said it was a carcinogen. Consumer Reports had the poisoned hand. Newsweek had the, you know, the witch picking as the same time as the farmer. It was devastating. And our industry got more proactive about being responsive. 2014, we have one lot of caramel apples that have listeria. That blocked all fresh apples from certain countries. They just used it politically. Said, well, you have listeria on your apples. Well, no, we have listeria in happy apples, ironically. But that didn't work. So we always have to be on top of it. So this is my few behind-the-scenes images. I crossed a big apple by a big apple. Had big apple trees and apples like that. Every single tree, tiny little apples. I showed this to a grower as an example of what markers could prevent us to do, and he said, I could sell those as apple nuggets. He hasn't pursued that, but we'll see. Two parents that did not have a closed calyx. I always look to see if closed calyx, so if the calyx is open like that, like Pink Lady does, you can get fungus to come in and then you get moldy core. Consumers don't want to eat an apple and find moldy core. So this, both parents had a closed calyx. Most of the progeny had an open calyx. I mean, they look like pomegranates almost. But then a processor saw it and said that would be perfect because when they don't cut off the calyx end and the anther stalks are in applesauce, people think that they're eyelashes. So he said, we could slice those off and process them. So no matter how bad something is, it may be an opportunity for somebody else. My goal here was to get attractive green fruit. This is why we don't show you the bad stuff. I'd say I failed miserably. Green is really tough. You cross green by green and you get really bad stuff. So I'm not giving up, but I'm giving up on that cross. Showing you the idea of variability. We do double flower crosses. The anthers don't dehisce, so it makes it really hard to breed. We can enclose them in a tent, but the side that is open is the sun side. The side that is closed is the shade side. It can be as subtle as that, and it can be as dramatic as that. Columnar crab apples. So we know that columnar apples have problems from a production standpoint, but for a crab apple, it makes quite a striking tree. And despite all of these interests, I have many advanced selections in the pipeline that we are very encouraged about. We've written a number of patents, and we have more patents coming. The yellow apple is the one with a slight hint of anise. The one on the bottom could break your teeth, but people said this is too firm an apple, and it was like, give me a break. You know, I mean, if my apples are too tough, I'm sorry, but that's not a bad thing for an apple, I don't think. So in summary, anybody studying anything should understand what the parentage pedigree of what you are studying is, because as hokey as the old saying goes, an apple really doesn't fall far from the tree, in kids and in apples. Know the literature, but question the literature. Keep your eyes open and notice patterns, because some of the stuff that I've kept, people would have walked by or just, you know, kicked over. Find helpful colleagues and network with your community of researchers. For the younger members of the audience, this community of ASHS is incredibly generous, and they love helping younger people. You're not being an imposition asking us for help. There's a lot of mentors out there, and that's the strength of being here. So if you go to somebody, you know, if you go to a meeting like this and you find something interesting, catch them afterwards. And realize if you email us and we don't answer, if you email us again, sometimes the guilt kicks in. We get a lot of emails, but it's not that we're not interested. But most importantly, which I hope I showed you today, any kind of research program is a blast. It's important to do the research and to do sound science, but you can also have fun at the same time. So I thank you for your attention to my talk, and I'd be glad to answer questions if we have a minute or two. Thank you.
You know, on the breeder, you view all genetic material, the gene, and also the environment detector, a grid detect on the like a size, color, yield. So you're not sure how to view this problem.
Sure. So stating that we have the genetic attribute, but the environmental attribute is equally important. And so how do we deal with that? So the easiest answer, which I don't think we do better in some fields of horticulture and its subgroups than others, is clonal propagation allows us to have replicates among a variety and examine that environmental attribute. Testing across multiple locations is also important. But I've found that I can plant in another area of New York and see disorders that I didn't see before. So it does really require that you test as many places as possible. Other questions? Paul, good to see you.
Are your colonial genes tend to be dominant or recessive or intermediate?
Dominant.
Please repeat.
Oh, sorry. Is the columnar gene dominant, recessive, or intermediate? I'm saying dominant, but Kanung Zhu's been doing some work on it. In a lot of populations, you'll see 50% or less. When we cross columnar by columnar, we do not see what you'd expect. And that's also bizarre. So I crossed columnar by columnar, and I thought that I had the wrong progeny because it didn't. They didn't look columnar, and then they grew to a certain stage, and then they started looking more columnar. So that's, it's the wonders of, with one copy of a gene, it may look one way, and with two copies of the gene, it might look completely different.
And you say it has no production
potential? Sorry, I shouldn't have said that. We have to get better quality. We have some things that we could name that have good quality. But we still have to deal with the biennial bearing, the need for spur renewal. So, you know, most people would say that tree archetype would not be ideal for commercial production. We'll have to prove them wrong. And I'll be around if anybody wants to reach me.
Thank you very much.